Christmas Day, 2009. A terrorist tries to blow up a plane while traveling from Amsterdam to Detroit. The bomb fails, and the young man is apprehended. Who inspired that plot? Anwar al-Awlaki, an American-born Muslim cleric turned recruiter for al-Qaeda. Awlaki's other followers include the Fort Hood shooter, the brothers behind the Boston Marathon bombing, and the extremists who carried out the Charlie Hebdo massacre. In this hour, New York Times reporter Scott Shane describes Awlaki's life and death, how, having been born in New Mexico and educated in Colorado, he became radicalized, eventually becoming the Obama administration's number one target after the killing of Osama bin Laden, and the first U.S. citizen assassinated in a drone attack. A terrorist, a president, and the rise of the drones, with Scott Shane, on Midday After the News. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here again. Thank you for joining us. Christmas Day, 2009, a young Nigerian man boarded a flight from Amsterdam to Detroit with very specific instructions. Wait until he is on U.S. soil to detonate the bomb hidden in his underwear. His mission was thwarted, however, when the explosives failed to detonate. Later, in the hospital, this young terrorist revealed that he had traveled to Yemen to join al-Qaeda and had met a man who suggested the plot to take down an American plane. This man connected him to a bomb maker, helped him film a martyrdom video, and gave him final instructions. The man was well known to authorities because the FBI had kept tabs on him dating back to 1999. His name was Anwar al-Awlaki, and he was an American-born imam. Our guest in this hour of the show is Scott Shane, national security reporter for the New York Times, a former Baltimore Sun reporter, and author of a new book about Anwar al-Awlaki, Operation Troy, it's called, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of the Drone. Operation Troy tells of the transformation of al-Awlaki from an American-born college student to a peace-preaching imam to a recruiter for al-Qaeda. And it tells of how drone warfare has changed modern warfare. When President Obama took office, he not only continued but expanded the drone strikes in Pakistan that President Bush had authorized in his last 6 months in office. The CIA carried out more than 80 drone strikes in Pakistan during President Obama's first 16 months in office. And President Obama added another country to the drone strike program, Yemen. And that's where the U.S. went after Anwar al-Awlaki. In this hour, why did an American who spent many happy years in this country as a child and a student come to coordinate attacks on U.S. soil? How did the president, a former constitutional law professor, justified the assassination of an American without due process? And can the killing of an American citizen without due process be justified? Scott Shane joining us now with his book, Objective Troy. Again, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of the Drone, published by Tim Duggan Books. Scott, nice to have you on the radio show with me. Nice to see you.
Dan, great to see you and honored to be on Midday.
Yeah, congratulations on this work. Of course, this is some reporting that you've done for the New York Times over several years. So a culmination for you of a lot of hard work that had gone into explaining and examining not only this man's life, but the U.S. policy, U.S. strategy on tackling terrorism.
That's right. I was actually looking for a way, a sort of storytelling way, to get at the issues that I've been writing about, like so many other reporters since 9/11, this sort of titanic clash between the U.S. and Islam, or a strain of Islam that has dominated so much of what our government has done since 2001. And this guy's life and death captures so much of that history, both on the kind of radicalization side, how a guy, as you mentioned, goes from being a seemingly quite successful and happy American to spending his last years, plotting to kill Americans, and of course the drone as an answer to the terrorism problem has turned out to carry a lot of complicated consequences as well.
We're going to go back to 9/11. We'll start there, maybe jump back into Alaki's childhood and then come forward. But it's so I have this memory even before I started reading your book, 9/11 and the days after, this man in Virginia, this imam in Virginia, fairly young, I don't know, late 30s, early 40s maybe, bearded with wire rim glasses. Now, that may describe many American clerics, Muslim clerics, but I think it was him. And I seem to remember interfaith, a service of some kind being televised, or certainly Alaki being interviewed around that time. And am I correct? And other Americans would have the same memory possibly, right?
I think that's right. You know, his first wave of fame came long before he was associated with terrorism. And in fact, it was sort of quite the contrary. As everybody remembers, after 9/11, there was this kind of scramble to understand something about Islam. And there were a lot of those kind of interfaith gatherings where, you know, a rabbi and a minister and a priest and an imam would get together and talk things over. And he was he really became a kind of go-to voice at that time, not just at those kind of interfaith events, but also for the U.S. media. A lot of Muslim clerics in this country, not surprisingly, like a lot of Muslims in this country, are immigrants. And many of them, you know, speak English with a heavy accent or speak it poorly or are older. Here was a guy who actually was even younger than your impression at the time. He was just 30 when 9/11 occurred. And so there's this young, you know, basically hip, well-spoken, very sophisticated sense of humor, you know, nice guy, kind of charismatic, you know, people person. And the media, you know, speaking as a reporter, everybody's looking for someone who can explain Islam. You know, we're still having this conversation, right? Is ISIS Islamic and so on?
Right.
And, you know, but back then he suddenly found himself as a very young and relatively new imam in that mosque, a big mosque in Falls Church, Virginia, right outside D.C., of course, right near a big media market. You know, reporters discovered this guy, and he was suddenly all over the national media.
And didn't he come to the Capitol at some point for a major event?
Yeah, even before 9/11, he had been invited to give the khutbah, the kind of sermon at Friday prayers in a kind of small prayer room that they used for Friday prayers at the U.S. Capitol, and it was attended by Muslim congressional staffers, you know, lobbyists, whoever was around, and he gave a sermon on the Prophet Muhammad as a statesman, basically sort of you know, matching his subject. So even before 9/11, he was sort of making his mark. His reputation was getting around. He was getting a lot of speaking invitations. And 9/11 just, you know, enormously escalated the demand for his views.
And this is a man who would become, it's safe to say, the most hunted terrorist after the death of Osama bin Laden?
Absolutely, yeah. He was, you know, in the last couple of years before his death in September of 2011, he was ranked by a lot of counterterrorism officials as actually more dangerous than bin Laden, because bin Laden was viewed as sort of sidelined and, you know, a bit past his prime, whereas this guy was with the al-Qaeda affiliate in Yemen, which was considered to be the one most actively plotting against the U.S., and he was also by far the most influential English-language propagandist for al-Qaeda worldwide.
So we'll explain during this hour with Scott Shane how Anwar al-Awlaki went from being on national TV and quoted by the press and taking part in interfaith services immediately after 9/11 to that status. But let's go back even further and start with his life story. So 1971, New Mexico, he's born to parents who are from Yemen, right?
Exactly, yeah. Nasser al-Awlaki, his father, was a Fulbright scholar, came to the U.S. as a Fulbright, and was sort of representative of you could say, I've always thought, sort of representative of a relationship between the U.S. and the Arab world, the Muslim world, that existed for a long time. My late father taught at George Washington University, and he was an engineer, and he taught sort of business subjects to engineers. And half his classes, were from the Middle East. So Nasser al-Malik, Anwar's father, was very much of that model. He came to this country. Yemen's the poorest country in the Arab world. He was from a well-off family, but he was, as he told me in interviews in Yemen, he was blown away by what he found in the U.S. One of the first impressions he shared with me was he was sent with some other Fulbright folks to somewhere in Kansas to do English language training to improve their English. And he was stunned to find that he could have as much milk as he wanted to drink.
Was he here to study agriculture?
Yes. And he ended up doing a PhD in agriculture science, and he stayed for 11 or 12 years. He became an assistant professor. So he really got into the U.S. And when he and his wife moved back to Yemen. With little Anwar, who was age 7 when they moved back, and their other kids, he went on to become the agriculture minister of Yemen and also a founder of a university, chancellor of another university, a very prominent guy. And he's a super nice guy. He's, people will probably wonder if Anwar's more notorious, sort of beliefs and activities came from the family. And the answer is absolutely not. Nasser al-Awlaki, the father, is a religious guy in a sort of conventionally religious site. People say that to be, that Islam in Yemen, very conservative, religious country, is sort of like being, Baptist somewhere in a little town in the southern United States. It's part of the air you breathe, and so the family was Muslim, but the father was very secular and Western in his orientation. And actually, one of the other brothers told me that there are three brothers in the family, and one of them was going to the mosque a little too much for the father's taste, and he forbade him from going to the mosque because he was afraid he was getting a little too into sort of political Islam, and he wanted this kid to sort of focus on his studies. So
one of the brothers told you that?
Yeah, one of the brothers
told
me.
The father actually discouraged him going to the mosque too much.
Too much,
so the father
exactly.
Wasn't particularly devout. Probably not as devout as other Yemeni.
Yeah, I would say not, yeah.
Interesting. So young Anwar spends 11 years there with his parents. So by the time he gets back to the United States, it's time to go to college. Is that
it? Yeah, exactly. His dad, who has gone to New Mexico State, gotten the engineering degree and went on to Nebraska and so on, He foresees for Anwar, who's a very talented student, a similar path. He wants him to come to the States, get a technical education, come back to Yemen where there are plenty of problems to solve. It's a country that's running out of water, right next to Saudi Arabia, but doesn't have much oil at all. So a very poor country with a lot of problems. And he thinks Anwar is, he's setting him on a course to kind of tackle these problems. So Anwar comes at the age of 19 to Colorado State, and he takes up, as his father wants him to, a degree in engineering, starts studying engineering.
And becomes, how does he get into deeper into religion? Does that happen while he's at college?
Yeah, it does. It's quite an interesting story. One of his brothers told me that when Anwar was packing to leave for the States, his mother, this is just sort of revealing in retrospect, his mother kept putting in a prayer rug, the kind of prayer rug that Muslims put down on the ground, six times a day to pray or five times a day to pray. And he kept taking it out. It was like, Mom, I'm not going to need this. I'm going to the States, And so he was not, as a teenager at that time, terribly religious. But he got to the Colorado State campus in Fort Collins, Colorado, and there is a mosque in basically a house at the edge of campus there, and it's not kind of big enough or flush enough to have a paid imam, a paid, you know, preacher. So professors and students take turns at Friday prayers giving this sermon. And he was invited at some point to give one or volunteered to give one, and he really kind of found a knack. And the other thing that happened was, and this was freshman year, this was like in winter break of freshman year, he fell in, you know, you can imagine Colorado State, he didn't go home. So he's hanging out on this kind of desolate campus, all right. The kids are gone. And he fell in with some very, very conservative Muslim students and just kind of went for it, hook, line, and sinker. So when his I talked to his roommate, his the guy who was his roommate second semester, who had kind of hung out with him first semester, Saudi guy, very, very nice guy. And he comes back, and they've agreed to room together second semester. And he's astonished at the transformation of young Anwar from a guy who was, like, you know, kind of interested in being a college student, doing a little drinking, a little partying, chasing girls, and so on. All of a sudden, he's this kind of puritanical scold, and he doesn't want his roommate watching television, which he thinks is haram, you know, sort of forbidden by Islam. And there's a kind of culmination where the guy comes, Anwar comes home, and the guy, his roommate, is watching TV. And Anwar picks up the TV and smashes it on the ground. Wow. So he's kind of gone whole hog for this very conservative brand of Islam. It's not at that point anything to do with terrorism or violence. And I think it's fair to say that the evidence is that he moderated his views. This was kind of, you know, like a guy who just quit smoking or something, you know, a bit of a fanatical thing. And I think he mellowed a bit in the years after that. But that's where the seed was planted. It's so interesting that you come from a conservative, religious, Muslim country, but the place where you get conservative Islam is Fort Collins, Colorado.
Colorado, yeah. We'll take a break here, Scott, and pick up the story there. Scott Shane is our guest in this hour of the show, a reporter of the New York Times, now with a book about Anwar Aliki. Objective Troy is called, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of the Drone. A short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Anwar al-Awlaki, American-born Muslim cleric turned recruiter for al-Qaeda. Would you say, Scott Shane, that he lives on in videos on YouTube all over the world, inspired the Fort Hood shooter, possibly, the brothers behind the Boston Marathon bombing, the extremists who carried out the massacre at Charlie Hebdo, all true, all had somewhere in there some inspiration from Anwar Aliki, or at least watched his videos, would you say?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the reason Obama ended up putting him on the kill list was that he was considered to be, at that point, an operational terrorist because he had actually had a hand in sending the young Nigerian you mentioned before, who became the underwear bomber, to try to blow up a plane over Detroit, coming to Detroit on Christmas Day in 2009. But his probably larger significance was not, this guy was not a bomb expert or anything. His larger significance was as a voice for sort of violent jihad. And that went back, you know, a number of years before his death. So he had quite an influence on Nidal Hassan, the army major, army psychiatrist who shot up Fort Hood also in 2009. But more generally, you can say that if you look at an English-speaking terrorist, someone either who carried out some kind of plot or was arrested and accused of carrying out a plot, it's very common, almost universal, that if the authorities look at the person's laptop and look at the history, that the person will have been listening to Anwar Awlaki, because he was just a formidable voice. He was a bestseller on CDs in his sort of mainstream days when he was in the States. He was an entrepreneurial guy, and he started putting out his lectures and sermons and sort of stories about the history of Islam on CD. And there are boxed sets, for example, a 53-CD set on the life of the Prophet Muhammad.
Wow.
And this stuff, Islamic scholars say, is completely mainstream, completely straight out of the Quran and the Hadith, the sayings of Muhammad, and has no certainly no direct connection to Al-Qaeda, to violence, to any of the stuff that came later. But all that is out there on YouTube, and all his later stuff after he became radicalized and joined Al-Qaeda is out there as well.
So going back to Colorado State,
yes,
after his freshman year, or you said during the winter break of his freshman
yeah.
year, from then on, he became, first of all, a leader of Muslim students at Colorado State, right?
Yes.
And then he really took a deep dive into the religion.
That's right. He, it's funny. There's a family drama in this book, along with a kind of, big stakes political drama. And that is that his father, this, secular technocrat educated in the state who told me more than once that he loves the United States, was pressuring him to finish his degree in civil engineering, get a job in engineering, get a little experience and come back to Yemen and help this country. He was bored by engineering, and he actually took off from Colorado State at another time over a different Christmas break and went to Afghanistan. And it was after the Soviets had withdrawn, after the so-called Mujahideen, the freedom fighters that Reagan had supported, that the U.S. had supported, the CIA had supported, had defeated the Soviets. The Soviets had withdrawn. But it was very much a kind of, heroic. There was a heroic image for those guys who supposedly had defeated a superpower with their shoulder-fired missiles and their AK-47s. And he went there, and according to others who talked to him about it, the trip was a bit of a disaster. He kind of froze. It's very cold in Afghanistan. He didn't do any fighting, but he was drawn to that. And meanwhile, he's kind of skipping out on his classes, not getting very good grades in the engineering stuff. In the end, he got a degree in engineering from Colorado State, but he actually took a job in engineering that lasted a couple months. His father, I think, really kind of turned the screws and said, "You got to go try out engineering." He left after a couple months and got a job as a part-time imam at the mosque in Denver, not too far away. His father, I know, was quite distressed at this. You can kind of imagine it. Similar family dramas go on all the time, right? This part-time job as an imam in Denver paid almost nothing. By then he had married a cousin from Yemen, and they had a kid while they were living in Denver. And so dad's like thinking like, what are you doing? What are you going to do with your life?
Right. Scott Shane is our guest in this hour of midday. Scott's book is Objective Troy, a Terrorist, reference there to Anwar al-Awlaki, a President, President Obama, and the Rise of the Drone. Now, before we go on, I'll ask you about the title of the book, Objective Troy. It sounds like a name for a military project of some kind.
Yeah, exactly. It turns out that if in our era where there's a kill list, the government doesn't like to use that that term, but it basically is the list of people who have been judged to be legally eligible, so to speak, for capture or kill. So a certain number of identified terrorists are on this list at any time. And the military has one list and the CIA has another list, and there's some overlap. The military gives all of the terrorists or suspected terrorists on the kill list, they're all called objectives, very, very typical military jargon. And then they're given a code name. So So Objective Troy was the code name for Anwar al-Awlaki when they were looking for him from 2009 to 2011. And the reason it was Troy, you know, you kind of think, geez, Trojan horse, this American who was betraying his country. He's wondered if the military had gotten sort of literary. In fact, they, you know, for purely random reasons, they decided to name all the targets in Yemen after towns in Ohio. And
how mundane.
And so Troy, Ohio,
because I was thinking
the one
the
that
latter.
Came up.
Oh, my goodness. I was thinking the latter, that that's how it came to be. Well, how did it come to be? How did Anwar al-Awlaki go from Falls Church, Virginia, and the imam there speaking to the national press and taking part in interfaith services post 9/11 to becoming the leading propagandist of al-Qaeda?
Yeah. Well, the first stage was that the FBI had suspicions about Anwar al-Awlaki. He had, it turned out, after 9/11, two of the hijackers, the 19 hijackers, praying at his mosque in San Diego. And some people thought they remembered one of those guys going to visit Anwar al-Awlaki as the imam in his office and talking to him privately. So this obviously, worried the FBI. They interviewed him several times after 9/11, and they weren't completely satisfied with his answers, although he said he condemned 9/11. He had condemned it publicly and privately. But they were a little concerned about what these connections meant, so they started following him around. They put a special surveillance group, kind of watchers on him. It takes a big team to follow somebody 24 hours a day in shifts. Everywhere he drove, they were after him. Everybody he met with, they checked out and so on. They tapped his phones. And what they found in the subsequent months after 9/11 was that they found no evidence that he was a terrorist, that he had been, had any idea ahead of time that 9/11 plot was going to happen. But he was visiting prostitutes on a regular basis. He would go to these hotels in D.C., and he was arranging the visits through an escort service. And so what happened was, one of the things I discovered in doing the research for my book was that he, the belief for a long time was that he had left the U.S. because he perceived too much hostility to Muslims in the months after 9/11. So he had left in March of 2002. What actually happened was he was quite happy. He was enjoying the limelight. He was becoming a national figure, as we've discussed. He told his younger brother that he was prepared to, spend his life in the States, and he had no intention of leaving. Then something happened. He got a call from the head of one of these escort services who told him the FBI had come calling with a lot of questions, and it was quite obvious that they had been monitoring all of his visits to prostitutes. Now, you got to put yourself in this guy's shoes. He was preaching in a conservative mosque. He had a whole sermon against fornication, zina in Arabic, had denounced, sort of dirty movies and this and that, and had taken, like a lot of preachers of many faiths, a pretty hardline position against this kind of thing. And he ran the risk of being ruined if this FBI file should become public or if he should be charged in connection with prostitution stuff. And that is actually what caused him to panic and take off. And that began that sort of threw him into a world, first in the UK and in London, Birmingham, other places, and then in Yemen a couple years after that, where he sort of fell in with more and more radical circles and began to get an ambitious guy and began to get sort of kudos and attention, not for the kind of moderate, explanatory, understanding preaching of brotherhood that he had become known for after 9/11 in the States, but a far more radical, far more violent version of Islam.
And what's at the root of that? Do you have a better understanding, having done this research for this book, Objective Troy, what that's about, the hatred of the West, the hatred of the U.S.?
Yeah, I think I have a much better grasp of it. One reason I set out to write the book is that even after, you know, more than a decade about writing about this stuff, I still had a hard time understanding what brings somebody to actively work to kill, you know, innocent strangers, civilians, and I think I do understand it a lot better now. I mean, part of what's going on there is a concept called the Ummah, the global community of Muslims. And I think in his trajectory, and it's similar to the trajectory of many people, many Muslims who have become radicalized and joined groups like Al-Qaeda, which I should say remains a very small minority of Muslims in general. He began to, his loyalty was not to his fellow citizens, but to the Ummah. And he came to believe and to say and to preach in the last years of his life that America was at war with Islam. Same thing that the Osama bin Laden had said. But when Osama bin Laden had begun saying, this is sort of the irony of this whole post 9/11 period. When Osama bin Laden first declared war in his own language on the United States back in 96 and then 98, he put out these sort of declarations of war. It seemed kind of insane. Like, what do you mean the U.S. is at war with Islam, at war with Muslims? What are you talking about? And he was very hung up by the fact that the U.S. had stationed troops, American troops, in Saudi Arabia, in what he called the land of the two mosques, this sort of holy land. That really upset him. But it seemed like a kind of lunatic notion. Mm-hmm. But what happened after 9/11? First, we invaded Afghanistan. Then we invaded Iraq. And then by the time we're talking about, we began drone strikes in Pakistan. We began drone strikes in Yemen. It became, it's a much more complicated thing than the U.S. being at war with Islam. I think that's a completely unfair way of describing the actual situation. But if you're a young guy, sort of impressionable, and you're looking out at the world and you're looking for an identity, it actually makes a lot more sense. So he would preach that you are a member of the Ummah, you're a member of the world community of Muslims, and your loyalty has to be to your fellow Muslims, not your fellow Americans or your fellow, you know, French citizens or your fellow Yemeni citizens. And America is killing Muslims. Well, you know, if you look out at the world, America is killing Muslims. It may be a lot more complicated than that, but that became, an attractive message. And to this day, it remains a very attractive message that's allowing ISIS, for example, to draw a lot of recruits.
Scott Shane, our guest in this hour, midday. Before we take our next break, Scott, could you compare, in terms of eloquence and the power of words, Osama bin Laden with Anwar al-Awlaki? Who was better at that? And I know al-Awlaki spoke English because he was an American citizen.
Yeah.
So that's distinguished them.
Yeah, it's sort of a generational thing. Osama bin Laden, though, although he could read English, he could probably speak broken English, he operated in Arabic. And I don't speak Arabic, but you can read translations of his speeches and you can watch him. He was sort of into high-flowing rhetoric and poetry, spoke very indirectly often, and he was sort of a little more of an ethereal kind of inspirational figure. Anwar al-Awlaki, he did some stuff in Arabic, which he spoke fluently. You know, he was native in Arabic since his parents were from Yemen. But he was also native in English and spoke English with an American accent and, you know, spoke slang, totally understood everything, could kind of lace his talks with references to American culture and to Western culture. He knew exactly how to push American buttons. He also knew how to appeal to Western Muslims and to the natural sort of insecurities of a Muslim minority in a country like America or in France or, other parts of the West, UK. So he was a sort of more down-to-earth speaker, more direct, more colloquial than Osama bin Laden. And, you know, for me, what I've come to realize is English is not just the language that they speak in the UK and the US. It is the language of global commerce. And in a way, this guy, Anwar al-Awlaki, became in his world sort of a brand, like a kind of borderless brand like Toyota or Apple. You know that Apple comes from the States. You know Toyota comes from Japan. But basically, everybody knows what it is. And everybody knows that the common language that they sell their products in is English. And that was true of this guy, too. He was selling a product very much in English.
You say the final video or the culmination of all his work was his call to jihad in 2010, recorded then. And by then, Anwar al-Awlaki was on President Obama's kill list and on the run in Yemen's tribal badlands. I'm quoting Scott Shane here. In it, with the confidence and poise of a YouTube handyman explaining how to cock a window, he details just why exactly it is every Muslim's religious duty to kill Americans.
Yeah. One of the interesting things about this guy is he was an early adopter of technology. So when his kid brother at the age of 17 came to see him in his first full-time job as a preacher in the States, which was at a mosque in San Diego, he had his teenage brother out on the sidewalk after Friday sermon selling cassette tapes of his sermons. Then, as I mentioned, he hooked up with a bigger publisher that started putting out box sets of his sermons and lectures on CD. He used something called PalTalk, which was a way to reach a large audience across the internet globally, and he would talk to audiences that way. In 2008, he started a website. He started a Facebook page, and today, he's been dead for 4 years, almost 4 years, but he's huge on YouTube, and I'd say he's big on a lot of Islamic sites that are more sort of specialized. But he's huge on YouTube. Most days, it sort of varies from day to day. People take stuff down, put stuff up. But most days, I find that if you put his name into YouTube, you come up with more than 40,000 hits.
Google. A Google search will give you 40,000 hits?
A search right in the YouTube search engine.
Just YouTube?
Yeah, just YouTube.
Wow.
And most of that stuff is him talking. And you can find this call to jihad where he explains why everybody needs to kill Americans, right there with the rest of the stuff.
Scott Shane is a national security reporter for the New York Times based in Washington, former colleague of mine at the Baltimore Sun. His book is Objective Troy, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of the Drone. More on this story with Scott Shane when we get back. Our guest this hour, Scott Shane of the New York Times, will be at the Enoch Pratt Free Library coming up in a couple of weeks, September 21st. Monday, September 21st at 6:30 p.m. He's the featured author there with his book Objective Troy about the hunt for and the killing, the assassination of Anwar al-Awlaki. So we say that he was the first U.S. citizen killed by the U.S. in a drone attack. That's accurate. Far as we know, right?
Well, first U.S. citizen deliberately killed. There actually have been 8 Americans killed, but they've all either been mistakes or what you'd kind of call an after-the-fact discovery where they take a shot at some people in Pakistan who they believe to be with al-Qaeda, and they discover later that one of them was an American citizen.
Okay, so keyword deliberately there.
Yeah.
And has the U.S. – is there any record of the U.S. assassinating any other citizens at any time deliberately?
That is the big controversy here. Obviously, drone strikes in general are controversial. The question of, is this the best tactic to use against terrorism? And I think – in particular, as the years have passed and the backlash from civilian casualties, from mistaken strikes, has grown, there's a real question about drone strikes in general. But when the Obama administration, when President Obama, you know, gave the orders essentially to look into the possibility of killing an American, this was early in 2010, you know, it was a pretty big deal because the Constitution says you can't deprive somebody of life, an American of life, without due process of law. And generally speaking, that means a trial of your peers and so on. And in this case, the Office of Legal Counsel, which is sort of the brain trust of the Justice Department, studied it in great secrecy and came up with a series of opinions that said that if somebody like Alaki was posed a continuing and imminent danger to the United States, to Americans, that it would not violate the law or the Constitution to kill him. There's still a lot of division in the legal community about whether that's a correct opinion or not.
Could there have been a trial in absentia?
You know, that is certainly one of the things that people have proposed. My understanding is that if you have the right to confront your accusers, and that would pose big legal problems to just say we're gonna try this guy with it. As it turns out, he was tried in Yemen in absentia. It was at a time when the former government in Yemen was trying to kind of cozy up to the U.S. and get some more counterterrorism money. And they actually put Anwar al-Awlaki on trial with two other guys and convicted him and sentenced him to 10 years in prison. It didn't have any meaning because he was out in kind of the Badlands. So they never arrested him, never picked him up. But that was an idea. The other ideas that were floated was, can you catch this guy and drag him back to the United States and put him on trial?
And would you risk American lives in the attempt to capture him, right?
Exactly. And you know, one of the things that I found in looking at this is that it's sort of an example of the way technology shapes history. Once you've demonstrated the capabilities of an unmanned aircraft to go out there with missiles and kill people, it's pretty risky politically for a president to order, say, SEAL Team 6 to go to Yemen and take some very serious risks to drop in the middle of the night and try to capture a guy who has, he and his armed bodyguards have vowed to die fighting rather than be captured. So, you know, if there is that drone choice, it makes it tough for a president to say, you know what, we're going to risk some American lives to catch this guy, even though we could kill him with a drone. So you can see how that decision to kill him, becomes a lot easier to make with that technology available.
I'm quoting a fresh news story from the BBC about the British use of drones just yesterday or the day before. The British Defense Secretary, Michael Fallon, saying that the UK would not hesitate to launch more secret drone strikes in Syria to thwart potential terror plots. He said the RAF strike that killed two British Islamic State jihadists was, quote, a perfectly legal act of self-defense. There are other terrorists, he said, involved in other plots that may come to fruition in weeks or months ahead. So the two Britons thought to be state jihadists, part of the Islamic State, who were eliminated, killed with a drone strike.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, many people who have studied the early history of the drone, how it sort of emerged in the 90s, and then they first armed drones shortly after 9/11, and obviously this weapon has sort of taken off. Now it's proliferating to other countries. That's one of the interesting things about the case of Anwar al-Awlaki is he has become a precedent. His killing has become a precedent now for other countries. So, you have to believe that British officials felt a little more comfortable giving the order to kill British citizens who have joined ISIS when they think back to President Obama having given the order in 2010 that was carried out in 2011 to kill an American citizen, Anwar al-Awlaki, in Yemen.
Scott Shane, our guest, his book is Objective Troy, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of the Drone. In 2010, when President Obama asked for this legal opinion, was that known? Is that something you reported at the time? Was that known publicly that the government was examining this question?
You know, it leaked in the spring of 2010 that the government had put, that the Obama administration had put Anwar al-Awlaki on the kill list. And so we all did write about it and, you know, kind of wondered about the legal reasoning. And there were some leaks to one of my colleagues that shed a little bit of light on that. But what's, you know, what's somewhat frustrating these days as a reporter is we, in 2010, I filed a Freedom of Information request to get all the legal opinions the Justice Department had written about targeted killing, as they call these kind of drone strikes. Having in mind not just Anwar al-Awlaki and the question of an American citizen, but any other legal opinions they'd written up. And it was denied. They refused. They said it was all secret. We're not going to give you anything. And we, in the New York Times, went to court, and we, ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, filed a separate suit. Anyway, after 4 years, we finally got two opinions, heavily redacted, laying out the legal reasoning that the U.S. government employed in approving and ordering the killing of this American citizen. And I have to say, as an American citizen, as a journalist, I kind of object to that. We weren't asking for sensitive intelligence about al-Qaeda in Yemen or about drone technology. We were asking for the legal arguments that allowed, you know, my government, our government, to order the killing of an American citizen without trial. And, you know, I have to say it was a little disappointing that it took 4 years in court to get even, partial answer from the government.
And what other question that you wrestle with in the book, and we don't have maybe time to examine it fully here, but that's why people should read the book, is the question of what was accomplished here? Did we save American lives by killing this U.S. citizen, or has his death escalated that possibility, heightened that possibility that more will be killed? Does his martyrdom inspire further acts of terrorism?
Well, I think that's a question that the U.S. government should be, you know, thinking pretty hard about right now. He was taken out as an operational an operational terrorist. He's not going to be sending any more underwear bombers to blow up planes over Detroit. But his importance, his greater importance, was never as a literal plotter of plots. His much greater importance is talking, you know, impressionable young people into the idea that their religious obligation is to kill Americans or attack the West and so on. And he's been extremely effective both when he was alive and after his death. The remarkable thing is that, you know, martyrdom, as in most religions, is a powerful concept in Islam. And the day, September 30th, 2011, the day that he was killed, he was spoken of as a martyr. And today, if you go out on YouTube, I said there are 40,000 hits for Anwar al-Awlaki on YouTube. A lot of them are sort of tribute videos to the martyr, Anwar al-Awlaki. And so his authority has actually been enhanced by his death at the hands of the American government. And I think it's hard to not to believe that at most this was a kind of Pyrrhic victory to take this guy out. And you wonder what President Obama thinks about it today.
Scott Shane has been our guest in this hour. Fascinating book. Great work, Scott. Congratulations on this.
Thanks so much, Dan.
Yep. It's called Objective Troy, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of the Drone. It's published by Tim Duggan Books. And a reminder, make a note on your calendar if you'd like to meet Scott and hear more of what he has to say about his book and this story, Monday, September 21st, 6:30 p.m. at the Enoch Pratt Library downtown. Thanks again, Scott.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you, everybody, and have a great afternoon.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.